especially welcome the January freshmen who allowed me to share a welcome dinner with them just a short while ago. And I'd also like to thank the Worrell Foundation for sponsoring this lecture and many other lectures in our series. At the beginning of Aristophanes' Birds, two Athenian men, Euripides, you get used to these names, whose name means something like of good hope, and Pisteteros, whose name means something like persuasive comrade or persuader of others, or maybe persuaded by others. These two men have left the city of Athens. They're searching for another city in which to dwell, a better city than Athens, and really, I think, the best of all cities. Euripides describes their endeavor as, quote, wandering in search of a spot without busy trouble, where having settled, we may dwell. And our goal is Tereus the hoopo, from whom we need to inquire if he knows of some such city that he has flown over. Now, in the Greek, what they are looking for is a topon apragmona, which might have been translated as a place without any matters of real concern. These two men are fleeing Athens to avoid the legal consequences of their debts. Thus, they are seeking out the mythological figure Tereus. Now, Tereus was once a human being who's been turned into a hoopo. And in case you don't know what a hoopo is, it's a very distinctive bird with a crown-like crest and a cruel-looking beak. Now, Tereus was also, according to the play, once in debt. And he's also flown about since he's become a bird, and he's seen many cities. So he is sought because he is, quote, prudent in all things that pertain to human or bird. And when our two Athenians actually find Tereus in the play, Euripides tells him that they're looking for an easygoing, soft city in which to settle. Literally, he says they are looking for a woolly city. Now, since that description does not make things clear enough, Tereus asked the two men, what sort of city is it in which they would most pleasantly dwell? Euripides answers, quote, where the biggest matters of real concern would be of the following sort. To my door early in the morning, one of my friends would come, saying, in the name of Olympian Zeus, you and your children, having festively bathed yourself, come early tomorrow to my place, for I'm going to put on a wedding feast. Now don't do anything else. If you don't come, then don't ever come to me at a time when I am faring badly. His companion, Pisteteros, answers the same question in this fashion. Quote, where a father, having encountered me, blames me in regards to his blooming son, as if he suffered an injustice in the following terms. A fine thing it is, you show off, when you encountered my son coming away from the gymnasium freshly bathed, and you failed to kiss him, to speak with him, to put the make on him, to fondle his balls. You, who have been my ancestral friend. Now, one could use these two statements, which have interesting similarities and differences, to try to develop a sense of the differences between the two main characters. However, a difficulty arises. The manuscripts of the Birds do not clearly identify which character speaks which speech. There are simply gaps that indicate the speaker has changed. Now, this applies to the earlier speeches that I've indicated or accepted as coming from Euripides. Editors and translators thus are left to assign the speeches as their sense, understanding, or best guess guides them. Some give this second speech that I just read, with its colorful language, to Euripides instead, reasoning that it is in some way imitative of the first speech, and he is the follower. Others give it to Euripides because he is understood to be the courser of the two men. Now, I think there really seems to me to be no way to be certain about this. I accepted this second speech as coming from Pisteterus because in its explicitness, it's a little more aggressive and a little less soft. I also think there's some gain for the interpretation of the play if one sees the two characters as partners with a common enterprise at the beginning, with Euripides occasionally taking the lead. If one assigns lines in this way, then part of the story becomes persuasion ascending and overtaking good hope. Now, some of the manuscript difficulties I just mentioned clarify themselves later in the play, when in lines 644, 645, Pisteterus introduces himself by name. That's the first time the name appears. And he also names Euripides. And after he does that, it gets a little easier to sort out to whom each speech belongs. But not all of the manuscript difficulties go away. The real end of these difficulties may come around line 845, after which there's good reason to think Euripides has left the stage, never to appear again, at least not in a speaking role. Now, ultimately, the differences between these two speeches I read has little consequence for my lecture. I really just wanted you to see where these two main characters started out and to see in their own words how they articulated this soft, concern-free life that they're seeking to ensconce within a suitable city. Tereus comments on the first speech, what I assigned to Euripides, that its speaker has an erotic passion for pragmata involving hardship. Now, I think this mention of matters of real concern or pragmata that involve hardship or distress has to be read ironically. That is, that first speech didn't mention any distress or hardship, really. But perhaps the mention of erotic passion is more on the mark. Now, if that is the case, Tereus is pointing to an erotic passion that is not serious or urgent, not heavy or pressing. The speaker of the second speech says, immediately following Tereus, and before the second speech actually occurs, that, quote, I also have an erotic passion for such things. This statement is a sort of preface to the second speech. Perhaps then these two speeches, outlining the weightiest sorts of concerns that our runaway debtors feel are compatible with their notions of the pleasant life, are meant to give us a prevailing notion of the similarity of their starting points. They are both erotic men, but they are also soft. They wish to pursue a kind of erotic activity that is free from harsh consequences. They do not dislike Athens, but would wish to have an Athens without consequences. Does Eros naturally or logically lead to life in a woolly city? Well, not all Eros or erotic activity is so soft. Consider Tereus, the man that they've gone to seek guidance from. His erotic passion, according to the myths about him and the lost plays about him, led him to rape and mutilate his sister-in-law. Now, after hearing these accounts by these two men of the level to which they wish the matters of real concern in their lives to be reduced, Tereus suggests some existing cities in which they might live. All the cities are rejected by Euripides. The first city proposed is proverbially situated in some farther than faraway place than the Red Sea. It is rejected because it is coastal and thus exposed to the reach of Athenian power. The second city is rejected because its name suggests the disease leprosy. Now, it may be wondered how one would be able to choose a city so as to avoid entirely disease. It is hard to say why the third city is rejected exactly. Its name suggests a man who is either one-eyed or a sycophant, or both. I think sycophancy is the likeliest reason, as it is most distinctive with respect to the previous two cities, and it is directly related to the trouble with lawsuits that made our main characters flee Athens. Now, after rejecting these three cities, Euripides asks about the life among the birds. What's that like? The depiction of the life of the birds that is given in response is easygoing and pleasant. It's something like a perpetual honeymoon. And that at this point, Pisteteros perks up, and he announces that he has a great insight and a project for the birds that will lead to great power if they would be persuaded by him. The search for the best city in which to dwell transforms from this moment onward into a project to found a new city. Presumably, this new city will better suit Pisteteros' desired life than any existing city that's been mentioned. It also becomes immediately evident that this new city that will be dubbed with the name Cloud Cuckoo Land does not consist in merely adopting the way of life of the birds. The birds are to settle down and construct a fortified city in the sky. It is also an immediate feature of this plan that this new city will not leave the rest of the world alone. Rather, it will aspire to rule over humans and, quote, and the very gods you would destroy. This is Pisteteros' original formulation of his proposal. I would place some emphasis on it. It is easy to lose sight of the fact that the original plan proposed by this soft, erotic man is literally the destruction or the disillusion of the gods. Somehow, his search for a soft place to live has led to the conclusion that the gods must be destroyed, and he must not only assume absolute rule over this new city of birds, but also over all other cities. It may be that the truly good private life of soft erotic pleasures can only be securely protected by this assumption of absolute tyranny. Now, after a considerable bit of persuasive argument that mainly centers around convincing the birds that they used to be the rulers of the world before the gods, Pisteteros succeeds in whipping the birds into agreement with his reasoning. The chorus of birds says, quote, "We hold life not worth living if we do not obtain kingship in every respect." But as persuasive as Pisteteros is, something is still resisting his plans. The birds are not fully endorsing his plan to destroy and then do without the gods. Their resistance seems to force him to adjust his rhetoric. At line 562, just shortly after the chorus had expressed such extreme enthusiasm, Pisteteros presents the project in the following way, quote, "From here on, they, human beings, are to sacrifice to birds, since the birds are the kings, and to the gods only afterwards." Now, this resistance-born confusion further transforms into the following question from the chorus of birds, quote, "And how will humans ever believe us to be gods?" This question from the chorus of birds leads to a series of questions and answers that illuminate both the reasons why the birds resist the project to make a city without gods and how one might go about trying to make such a God-free city. I think in what follows, it's best to consider what Pistitaris has in mind as an attempt to found a city and thus politics upon wholly human powers or capacities. That is, he is holding true to his original plan to destroy the gods and to do without them. And it is best to consider the birds as human beings. The bridge is already there in the figure of Tereus, who once was a man and now is a bird, and other human beings gain wings and join the ranks of the birds throughout the course of the play. Question one. The first question that the chorus asks is rather subtly put. It is, how will human beings believe us to be gods when, quote, we who fly and have wings? Now, what is being asked about here? This may be a kind of question about what kind of beliefs about the rulers and their capacities are necessary among the ruled. The birds who fly by means of wings are natural beings whose natural capacities can, in principle, be assessed and understood. One might contrast this image especially with that of gods who fly without wings. This is a kind of power without evident natural limits. Who knows what else such beings might be capable of? Now, humans who try to take charge of their lives and try to conduct it by means of their own capacities will also be natural beings whose limits are exposed to those who can read human nature. If humans can fly, the means by which they do so will still mark them as limited beings. Now, here we might go further and remember that Tereus was originally sought out in part because of his ability to fly. In that context, flight was a stand-in for knowledge. Because he flew around, he was presumed to know many things. This might refer rather simply to the kind of knowledge humans would acquire by traveling. But it could also apply to human augmentation of the capacity to know by means of technology or even by means of certain ways of life. If this question is taken in this direction, then it is not just about the limits of human power, but especially about the limits of human powers of knowing and about the perception of those limits. To what extent must one obey another whose powers of knowing are known to be limited? To what extent does political authority require the impression that the ruler's powers cannot be assessed? Pistitaris' answer to this first question is that Hermes and many other gods fly and have wings. What is achieved or meant to be achieved by this response? At first glance, Pistitaris seems to be avoiding the main issue. If we think about Hermes in the usual depictions, he may have wings on his helmet or his ankles, but they are not of a size to support natural flight. He has wings, but he does not fly by means of wings. He still represents a divine power whose limits may not be assessed. If we think of flight as a metaphor standing in for knowledge, again, there are no apparent limits to what a divine being might be able to know. Pistitaris' answer hardly seems to achieve anything. However, we might consider Pistitaris, the master persuader, as pointing out something that will tend to be persuasive to the human psyche. That something is resemblance. The tales told about the gods often, almost always, present them in ways that resemble human beings. This might not just be a persistent feature of poetic depiction. It might be a natural tendency of human psyches to depict to themselves all beings along the model of natural beings. That is, as long as the way human beings tend to think of their gods is similar to the way they think about human beings, there is a bridge along which effective persuasion might work to transfer acceptance of the authority of one to acceptance of authority of the other. Question two. The next question posed is posed by Euelpides. He says, quote, "But won't Zeus thunder and send winged lightning down on us?" The concern here seems to be fear of divine power and of the possible punishment it might inflict. Zeus's lightning may threaten absolute destruction, but conceivably, divine punishment could extend much farther, even to some kind of eternal damnation. Pistitaeus' response is indirect in two ways. It directs itself to the birds rather than to Euelpides. And it does not address the concern that those who offend Zeus will suffer under his divine wrath. To the birds, Pistitaeus says, quote, "And if they still," that's they as humans, "if they still, out of ignorance, believe you to be nothing, and the gods to be those who are on Olympus, then it will be necessary for a united cloud of sparrows and seed pluckers to gobble up their seeds from the fields, and then to let Demeter measure out grain to them in their starvation." What Pistitaeus does here is to pit the accessible, limited, but reliable power of natural beings against the potentially unlimited, but unreliable power of the supernatural. Pistitaeus pits fear against fear. If you fear the harm that Zeus might do to you, Pistitaeus proposes eclipsing the fear of that potential harm by making you fear the harm that the this-worldly power of the birds can do to you. Zeus's power may be very great, but how many offenders of Zeus have you ever seen suffer at his hands? The birds will make you see and feel the suffering that they can inflict. It is no accident that the example Pistitaeus chooses is to have the birds cause a famine. How well will human beings be able to hold in their minds a concern with possible supernatural punishment when their concrete everyday sustenance is being threatened? Faithful fear of possible but perhaps irregularly or even never experienced divine wrath is being counterbalanced here against very evidently existent and present worldly causes of fear. Which will prevail in the human psyche? Now, Pistitaeus doesn't leave it at that. He amplifies his answer. He says further, quote, "And again, the crows shall pluck out the eyes of the oxen with which they plow the earth, and of their sheep as proof of your power. And then let Apollo, who is the healer, heal them and earn his fee." This amplification, with its promise of mutilation of animals, is a thinly veiled threat of bodily harm. Not only is the power of Zeus being challenged, but also that of Demeter and Apollo. In each case, the souls of human beings are being tested. Just how much do they care about what divine beings might do to them or what they might offer them? Can such cares sustain themselves in the face of the kind of harms and benefits that may be provided by ordinary human powers? It strikes me that the way Pistitaeus tries to address this question about the power of Zeus is not unlike methods employed in the modern nation that tried to do without gods, the Soviet Union. One poignant example is depicted in the 1990 film Europa, Europa. In an early part of that film, after Poland is divided between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, young Poles and others in the Soviet-occupied territory are enrolled in a komsomol designed to make them into good, godless communists. After a lesson about how religion is the opiate of the masses, some of the Poles object and insist that God exists. Now, when this happens again a little later, their communist teacher is ready for them. The teacher says to the Poles, quote, "Let's try a little experiment. You all know how to pray, don't you? Then pray. Lord, as a sign of your existence, send us candies from heaven." The Poles hesitate. The teacher says, "What are you waiting for? Go on." And the Poles start to pray. They say, "Lord, send us candies." And nothing happens. The teacher says, "Louder. I heard nothing, and your God is way up in heaven." So more and louder prayer ensues, with no evident result. The teacher then turns to the other students who are going along with the communist doctrines, and she says to them, "Now repeat after me, beloved Comrade Stalin, send us candies." There's a grate in the high ceiling of the room, and at this signal, candies are dropped down through the grate. The lesson in that movie is clear. The power of Stalin is certain. It is real. It is reliable. Despite the evident reality of human power and its relative reliability, can it ever have more than a momentary persuasive success against the counterclaim of the limitless power of the gods? What soul would take side with the here and now and for a while against the possible forever? Well, consider the flip side of the image of Zeus's lightning. To those who have not transgressed, Zeus's lightning represents justice. And like the nourishment of Demeter and the healing of Apollo, the justice of Zeus could be conceived of as a good that divine power can offer human beings. Who would prefer human justice to that offered by a god? One might remember here the Bible. In 1 Samuel 8, verse 8, chapter 8, God is dwelling among the people of Israel in a tent. Divine power could hardly be more available or evident. And quote, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" This choice by humans to take matters into their own hands and to live by their own guidance is practically definitive for politics. And it seems to be the judgment of 1 Samuel 8 that politics is intrinsically a rejection of the divine. In verse 7, the Lord God says, quote, "They have rejected me." Should we then understand that not only is rejection of the divine the logical consequence of Pistitarus' desire to secure and protect his own private life of soft erotic pleasures, but it is also the logical consequence of politics itself. Is politics itself based upon a preference for the goods that can be provided by human power alone, and a greater respect for the harm of which human power is capable? Question 3. Now, after addressing the fear of Zeus's lightning by distraction from that fear to more immediate sources of fear, Pistitarus finished the discussion by explicitly turning to the matter of providing good things. He says, quote, "But if they hold you, the birds, to be God, you life, you earth, you Kronos, you Poseidon, every good thing shall be theirs." Now this claim leads to the third question, which is posed by the chorus of birds. Quote, "Tell me one of those good things." Pistitarus answers, quote, "First, the locusts will not eat up their grape flowers, but instead a single regiment of owls and kestrels will bear down upon the locusts. And then the bugs and mites will not always eat up their figs, but instead a single flock will pick the figs all clean. Here Pistateris seems to be pointing out that nature, as overseen by the gods, is not so kind to human beings. Once again, Pistateris seems to be relying upon the thought that if his political arrangements can show that he has at his beck and call reliable powers capable of providing easily sensed benefits to human beings, such benefits will be preferred to the uncertain benefits offered by the gods. It may be that with the references in this answer to the destruction of the locusts, bugs, and mites by a single regiment of birds, these pleasant benefits are meant to call to mind the destruction of political enemies. Question 4. The next question is posed by Tereus. Quote, "But from what source will we make them wealthy? For this is what especially their erotic passion is for." It may be a little strange to suggest that the desire for wealth is an erotic passion. It is not perhaps so strange to suggest that what human beings want most is wealth. In Aristophanes' play entitled Wealth, wealth is also presented as what human beings most want, and it is something for which they pray to the gods. What is striking about this is that human beings should ask divine power to give them things that in principle are attainable by unassisted human efforts. Wealth can be understood, by the way, to lay claim to being a sufficient means by exchange to acquire any humanly producible or accessible good. If wealth is truly what human beings want most from the gods, then a powerful and effective human regime would seem to be able to make it a strong case for doing without the gods. For such a regime could become very good at providing human beings with wealth. And how would such a regime achieve the desired prosperity? Pistateris' answer is, quote, "When they come to seek divinatory advice, these, the birds, will give to them minds of worth, and they will inform the seer about profitable voyages of trade, so that no shipowner will be destroyed." Now, this answer seems to play upon the religious traditions that hold bird signs to be a source of augury. But it begins to become clear in the sequel that divinatory power is not what is being offered. Quote, this is Pistateris continuing, "One of the birds will always warn the one seeking divinatory advice concerning the sailing that now is not the time to sail, a storm is coming. Or, sail now, there will be profit." The way to wealth is through the extension of human knowledge. How might one know in advance, for instance, about the weather? Some kind of natural science seems to be the answer. And maybe there is even here some suggestion that the powers of human knowing might be extended through technology. Pistateris' next lines, though delivered as if the argument literally depended upon a proverb, also make it clear that extension of human knowing is the way to secure wealth. He says, quote, "And they will point out to them the treasures of money that people have previously buried. For these know. Everyone says, no one knows where my treasure is unless it's a little birdie." Question 5. The next question asked by Tereus again is, quote, "But how will they, the birds, give them, human beings, health, not wealth, which is in the lap of the gods?" Now Pistateris answers, quote, "If they prosper, is this not great health? know clearly that a human whose affairs are going badly is simply not one who's in good health. The surface meaning of this answer depends upon a play on the words oi pratos, faring well. I mean, that phrase could certainly be taken to mean enjoying material prosperity, but it almost literally describes being healthy. Now, is there any relation between these two understandings of oi pratos? The answer to that question might depend upon the consideration of the answer to question four above. Is health a good that is acquirable by means of human power alone? If so, then presumably wealth can be exchanged for health. But Tereus's question points to the limits of human knowledge and technology. If health, or some aspects of health, remain outside of the realm of human control, then it is clearly harder to offer human beings substitutes for the divine in this matter. One tactic we've already seen is to offer distractions when effective substitutes are available, when effective substitutes are not available. And this is another possible meaning of Pistitaris's answer. Could enough wealth make human beings forget about their concern with health? Question six. The last question is asked by the chorus. Quote, but how will they ever make it to old age? For this is in the hands of Olympus, or must they die in childhood? This suggests that span of life, or fate, is up to the gods. The concern is that without some divine dispensation, there will be no span of life. But Pistitaris answers, quote, by Zeus, no. By Zeus, no. But 300 additional years will the birds add to their lifespan. When asked where this lifespan is derived, or whence this lifespan is derived, Pistitaris refers again to a proverb. He's, quote, from where? From themselves. Don't you know that 500 generations lives the cawing crow? Now, as with the question of health, long life is proposed as something that cannot be secured by human power alone. And so the hope for long life compels one to turn to the gods for aid. But the conceit of the proverb in Pistitaris's answer is that birds have long lifespans and can share some to lengthen the lives of humans. But such an answer dwells merely at the level of wordplay. What is really meant here? If I remember to think of the birds as humans, guiding their own lives according to their own capacities, then there is no mythological store of extra life to draw upon. What really seems to be suggested is that the lives of some might be extended by choosing to shorten the lives of others. What this would almost certainly mean in the ancient world is the institution of division of labor, including slavery, to create the possibility of more leisurely and prolonged lives for some. Now, modern technology may alleviate this to some degree, but technology itself seems to depend considerably upon division of labor. And division of labor may continue to mean assigning to some human beings jobs that shorten and in other ways diminish their lives. At the end of the play, Pistitaris' tyranny has savage consequences for some of the birds. When envoys from the gods come to sue for peace, they are distracted by the savory smells of burning meats. Those meats are birds. Quote, this is Pistitaris explaining what he's cooking. Some birds, having risen up against the people's party of the birds, were judged to have committed injustice. So explains the tyrant. One of these birds could very well be Euripides. He disappears from the play, as I said before, after line 845, a line where he is questioning the orders of Pisistratus. These orders were to assign Euripides to hard physical labor working on a great wall. The last thing that is said to him is, quote, "Good fellow, go where I send you, for nothing of what I say will be accomplished without you." The last words might seem to smack of some continuing partnership, but one could wonder whether there is any room for partnership in Pisistratus' logic. The consumption of the rebel birds can be seen as a metabolic metaphor for the extension improvement of one's own life at the expense of the lives of others. In Pisistratus' answer to this sixth and final question, he first says the birds will add 300 years to human lifespans. Next, he says this span of life will come from birds who live 5 human generations. If a human generation were taken to live around 60 years, then the 300 years borrowed from the birds would consume all the years they had to give. But is there not lurking at this last question an even bigger and unnamed challenge? Does not the desire for a greatly increased lifespan suggest the even more radical desire for a life that never ends? The notion of mortals becoming undying ones is far from foreign to the Greek myths. In fact, Hercules appears late in this play, and his illegitimate birth is noted. So what can Pisistratus' project offer to human beings who wish for immortality? One could not borrow it from other human beings the way one might borrow long life. But glory might operate somewhat along these lines, and one can borrow that from other human beings. Science and technology might at some point offer a more literal biological immortality, but we are not there yet. It would seem that a purely human city might have to leave the human wish for immortality unfulfilled. How does that affect the capacities of such a human city? To assess this question, we might look at Pisistratus' city in its completion. Following Pisistratus' plan, Cloud Cuckoo Land successfully converts human worship away from the gods to the birds. Pisistratus proclaims to a stunned Iris, the messenger of the gods, quote, "The birds are now the gods for humans." This is a confident and victorious proclamation. But how victorious is the situation if one measures it against Pisistratus' original intention? How much has he achieved what he wished to do? And how much has he had to compromise and cover over the shortcomings of his project with persuasive rhetoric? A character appears late in the play who might shed light on what, if anything, remains undone or unresolved. This character first appears covered up, and then proceeds to hide his activity from the gods by covering himself with a parasol. He is the god-hating god and friend of human beings, Prometheus. He briefly appears to let Pisistratus know, in all essentials, the war against the gods has been won. The birds' great fortifications have prevented the smoke of the sacrifices from rising up to the gods, and so the gods are starving. Prometheus declares explicitly, quote, "Zeus is destroyed." Same word. What this starving of the gods might mean, in a non-metaphorical sense, is that one wins against the gods merely by diverting human attention away from the gods. But Prometheus is not here only to announce the victory of Cloud Cuckoo Land. He's also here to give human beings a gift. This time he does not give fire, the source of knowledge and technology. This time he gives Pisistratus advice regarding the peace negotiations with the gods. He tells Pisistratus to get Zeus to hand over Basileia. This is sovereignty personified in the feminine. Thus, Prometheus indicates that even a project to do without the gods might have to borrow something crucial from the gods. The transfer of the symbol of legitimate rule, taken over from the predecessors, may be needed to give this godless city the appearance of the kind of authority that had previously been granted to the gods. Now, why is this kind of authority needed? I would suggest it is because some things that a city might find it necessary to demand from a citizen cannot be wholly justified on the basis of rational self-interest. A city might have to command a citizen to give up their own life. Without the ability to guarantee a desirable afterlife, that is, immortality of the sort the gods might offer, even a city that had the scientific capacity to extend this worldly life indefinitely would have a very difficult time arguing that giving up one's life could be anything other than a personal loss. But perhaps by taking over the sense of legitimate authority from its supposedly divine predecessors, this city of human beings can take over the sense that even such an ultimate sacrifice is owed to the city. This taking over of sovereignty from the gods might be the last stroke of persuasive rhetoric that is needed to give human beings the sense that they owe to the city of man what they formerly owed to the city of gods. That this task is to be performed by persuasive rhetoric gives some indication of how to think about the birds in this play. As Cloud Cuckoo Land becomes powerful and popular, many immigrants sue to become citizens. Some are rebuffed, but those who are accepted, these human beings become birds. They become birds by being given wings. To some degree, the wings may be thought of as the kind of knowledge that a traveling human being can acquire, one who no longer remains within the narrow horizon of their hometown. This broad-minded view from above may also be connected to more general and even technological modes of extending human powers of knowing. This aspect of becoming winged might be associated with good hope. But the wings can also be associated with the power of words, of winged rhetoric. At one point, when he is considering inducting a new citizen, Pisistratus says, quote, "I am now giving you wings through speech." And he quickly adds, quote, "All are through speeches made aflutter." This aspect of human wingedness depends upon persuasion, which seems to extend beyond good hope and to fill in and cover over the matters where good hope cannot truly be offered. How much ease and peace of mind can a merely rhetorical solution offer in the end? To mention just one thing that Pisistratus' rhetoric has distracted us from and tried to make us forget, that is Zeus's power to harm us, asked about in the second question, that has been largely unaddressed. After all, if one only asks about what we fear from the gods and what we want from the gods, we have failed to ask the more worrisome and threatening question. What do the gods want from and demand from us? What are we permitted to take up into our own hands and to guide by our own lights? Zeus's lightning threatens those who do not live up to the gods' demands. In the face of this possibility, it would seem a parasol is an inadequate defense. Thank you.